Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. My guest for this Spotlight Edition is Dr. Sahil Chopra, a quadruple board certified physician in internal medicine, pulmonary medicine, critical care, and sleep medicine. Dr. Chopra trained at UCLA, Loma Linda University, and Harvard Medical School, where he developed a deep foundation in the science and physiology of sleep. He is the co-founder and chief medical officer at Empower Sleep, a digital platform redesigning how we diagnose and treat sleep disorders using continuous real-world data as opposed to one-night sleep studies. At Empower Sleep, Dr. Chopra is performing highly personalized, accessible care in a home-based format that is transforming patient outcomes. We hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, Sahil, thanks for joining me again on the Spotlight Edition. So excited to continue this conversation. As you were describing last episode on the value of Empower Sleep, what I'd love to do is kind of zoom out and meet many of our listeners and patients where they may already be, which is possibly and likely some involvement with some sleep data. And, you know, I've always thought of it as the original sleep tracker is usually our spouse or partner in the bed next to us. So even if you're just getting elbowed during the night, that's involvement in sleep health. But now with some wearable devices, popular ones like the Oura Ring, Whoop devices, Apple Watches, Garmins, there's so much action in this field. And I want you, from your perspective as a sleep expert, to help me navigate, help our listeners navigate how to approach this data and understanding the usefulness of it without becoming overwhelmed by it. So how do you approach when you talk to somebody who's engaged in the wearable devices?
Yeah, that's a complex question. The way that I would invite the patient to think about this is first starting off with symptoms. Like how do they feel their sleep is subjectively? And an easy way to do that is to ask yourself these few questions. How easy is it for me to fall asleep? Is my sleep relatively consolidated? Meaning, is it free of excessive nighttime awakenings, subjectively speaking? The third question is, do I wake up rested? And the fourth question is, do I have an adequate level of energy during the day? And, you know, if all of these questions, when answered, the answers are closer to normal. Like I can fall asleep easily, sleep is consolidated, I wake up rested, and my energy levels are fine. Then I think that's a really good place to be. If there is dysfunction in any of those four categories, and you have a wearable device that tells you that your sleep is abnormal, either from the context of sleep efficiency, total sleep time, or sleep duration, or if your sleep stages are substantially off, like if your wearable device tells you that you have no deep sleep, for example, something is clearly wrong. Or if any of these black box numbers, like a readiness score or a sleep score, is really low consistently, like something is wrong. So if one is in either of these extremes, meaning you have no symptoms and you feel good and your numbers are good from a wearable standpoint, like nothing to do, like continue doing what you're doing. But if you have some level of dysfunction, symptomatically speaking, and your biomarkers from your wearable device are far from what should be normal, then we should dig a little bit further. And the question becomes, what do I do if these numbers are substantially abnormal? And the only way to identify why that's the case is by doing a sleep study. And by doing that, we can then figure out what do we need to do to reverse engineer healthy sleep.
Yeah. You know, and one thing that comes to mind as you share that is, you know, as good as algorithms are and as AI can be, you know, to my understanding, some of the wearable devices, you know, it's primarily data with some very broad kind of population-based recommendations based on, you know, glorified handful of metrics. And I'm sure the CEO for Aura would disagree with me. But I think it's important to point out that what Empower Sleep does with your wearable device is very personalized with interpretation from a sleep expert. And that there is that filter of not only seeing the data, but being able to interpret it at a very high level. And so I wanted to point that out just because since a relationship with your company would be virtual, it is a relationship and it is interaction and it is feedback and it's medical history and it's the subjective with the objective. So I wanted to make sure to point that out. Is there anything you'd share in addition to that thought?
No, that's spot on. Data without context is not very helpful. And data with context without guidance is, again, not very helpful. And what we try to do is like stitch all of that together, where you have a board certified sleep specialist with medical grade sleep testing data, giving the patient guidance on what to do and what not to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be really overwhelming to see all that data. And especially if you're someone who doesn't sleep well and you wake up and you immediately look at your phone to get the data, what a terrible way to start your day. And especially without the context. And then like we referenced in a prior conversation, you then find yourself reaching for magnesium or melatonin or something known to help with sleep, but it may not be helping with your specific sleep issue. And that can be missed. So I'm so excited to have learned about Empower Sleep and to recommend you to many others. Yeah, as we take kind of the next step away from the wearables, I want to talk about some kind of common populations that struggle with sleep, or have medical complications that could either impact their general health or conditions that impact their sleep. Let's start with alcohol use. And I know this will be broad. I'm just going to kind of ask you for kind of a 10,000 foot perspective, but kind of tell me about how alcohol affects someone's sleep. And then we'll unpack kind of some recommendations to make sure that alcohol use doesn't cross that threshold to be harmful to one's sleep pattern.
Yeah, at least acutely, alcohol, and it depends on the dose as well, but generally speaking, alcohol will suppress the amount of deep sleep and the amount of REM sleep that one has, and it will cause sleep to be of poorer quality and with a lot more fragmentation. So one can possibly fall asleep faster if they've had a lot of alcohol to consume. And people use it often as a nightcap. But the quality of sleep that they have is poorer because there is less deep sleep and less REM, at least in the short term.
Yeah. You touched on one of the points there where I mourn when patients find themselves having a drink to relax at night or to get to sleep, and using that as their tool of selection, because I obviously, like you know, that it's, you know, we have to acknowledge it's effective with mental health and with sleep, but it's at a high cost. What are some things that you would tell individuals who do maybe enjoy a drink at night, or not even nightly, but every so often? Is there any recommendations you'd have as far as separating the alcohol intake from the onset of sleep by a certain amount of time, or a specific dose that you would recommend they not overcome so that they can protect their sleep?
Yeah, a couple of thanks for bringing this up. One of the things, and this is just like a rule of thumb, like everyone metabolizes drugs at a different rate. You know, everyone metabolizes alcohol at a different rate. But generally speaking, you want to give yourself 1 hour for each drink before you go to bed. So for example, if you've had two drinks, then give yourself 2 hours before you go to sleep. If you've had five drinks, give yourself 5 hours before you go to sleep, assuming you can metabolize that in that window, so that you don't go to sleep intoxicated. You go to sleep towards the tail end. Those are like some of the evidence-based things one can do to mitigate the effects of alcohol on their sleep. For the occasional, you know, if someone is drinking because they're partying, that's a very different context. But if someone is having a drink for the sole purpose of wanting to fall asleep, I would actually invite them that, hey, I would have this conversation with them that if you're going to spend 15, 20 minutes having a drink just so that you can quote unquote feel more relaxed, would you be open to sitting down with me for 15 to 20 minutes and doing a meditation practice or a breathing exercise? And I almost guarantee you that if done consistently across time, that individual will probably feel less anxious and drink less alcohol and sleep better as a byproduct of replacing that alcohol from something that is not conducive to sleep to something that is conducive to a better mental health and better sleep.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great reminder for the power of meditation, mindfulness. And I also appreciate you a few seconds ago mentioning just that framework of drinks and hours before bedtime. I think that's useful for members to kind of have that, just that framework of how to, you know, put themselves in a better position, as opposed to waking up tired or engaging in behaviors that constantly impact their sleep negatively. Shifting gears from alcohol, chronic stress. And I know I'm giving you big topics, and like I said, we'll stay 10,000 foot view here. A lot of talk in the social media world about cortisol levels and the effects of chronic stress. We work here at our practice at Brentwood MD, a lot of professionals, active business owners, busy individuals with a lot of stress in their lives professionally. And then, of course, personally, you may have a lot of stress in life. How does chronic stress impact one's sleep? And how do you navigate those conversations when maybe you see the data point toward more of a stress-induced sleep disorder?
Yeah, it's a tough problem to solve, but there are solutions. And if we look at this purely from the lens of what stress does to the autonomic nervous system, from a sympathetic parasympathetic balance, people who have more stress are in more of a sympathetic overdrive state as compared to people who have less stress. And we can see that in sleep studies. People who are in sympathetic overdrive during this window of sleep will have poor quality sleep versus people who are in a more rest and digest, a more parasympathetic predominant state before they go to bed or when they go to bed. So stress is kind of like the enemy of sleep. It's almost as bad as light would be for an individual.
Yes.
And but there are ways to mitigate that. And, you know, we touched briefly upon meditation. There are strategies, both mostly behavioral, that can boost our parasympathetic nervous system before we go to bed, ranging from breathing practices to vagal nerve stimulation to meditation to deep muscle relaxation. All of these things can help not just improve sleep, but it will improve sleep because one is in a less quote-unquote stressful state before they go to bed. And we also know that people who stress, that cortisol is a stress hormone, and cortisol promotes wakefulness. So if we are in a better stress management mode and cortisol levels are lower than, or like I'll phrase it as that they are physiologic and they are where they're supposed to be, then one will sleep substantially better as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we're, I feel like even in our conversation about these special populations, we're dropping some little cliffhangers of like, oh, you know, meditation or breathing exercises, vagal nerve stimulation. And I do want to take a moment to encourage individuals to consume more of your content through Empower Sleep that dives into more of the specifics around that, blogs and videos, as well as ours at Brentwood MD, because it helps to unpack some of those specific things. So if someone's listening and, you know, really has a, you know, if one of those terms resonates with them, it's like, oh, that somebody told me that before. Somebody's really benefited from that before. Learn, definitely search it out and learn more about it. Y'all have great content. The last population I want to hit on, I feel like I'm throwing you like, you know, a 70 mile an hour fastball, then an 80, and now I'm throwing you a 90 mile an hour fastball. Weight management. What's the relationship, the two-way street between how sleep quality can affect weight and how weight can affect sleep? Just help our members and listeners kind of maybe understand more about how important understanding their sleep health is when they encounter challenges with their weight, whether they're struggling to lose weight or they're gaining weight unexpectedly. Help me unpack that with our listeners.
Yeah, it's a chicken or the egg two-way. There is a bidirectional relationship between weight or obesity and sleep issues. And we'll start off with, if you take a healthy person who is not overweight and you disrupt their sleep, either through sleep deprivation or inducing sleep apnea by blocking their nose or something along those lines, what that results in physiologically is a dysregulation in two very important hormones that regulate satiety, our hunger drive, leptin and ghrelin. These are hormones that regulate how much we eat and how easily we feel full. So people who have sleep disruption, either in the form of jet lag, sleep apnea, shift work, sleep deprivation, they will have a higher likelihood of consuming more carbohydrate-rich foods at higher doses than those individuals who have more physiologic levels of leptin and ghrelin. So what we do know is, like, if someone's sleep is disrupted, it's not their fault that they are eating more. Their hormones have been altered as a byproduct of bad sleep that causes them to feel more hungry and eat more carbohydrates. Okay. So, like, that itself will, over time, if there is the absence of exercise and over calorie consumption, lead to more weight and obesity and all of those downstream processes. As one gains more weight, then, that puts them at a higher risk of developing this condition called obstructive sleep apnea, where there is excessive amount of weight in the upper up, excessive amount of adipose tissue in the upper airway, and airway becomes smaller in size, more prone to collapsibility, more upper airway obstructions, more sleep apnea, more pauses in breathing, more sleep disruption, more dysregulation, therefore, in leptin and red ghrelin, and it's a vicious cycle. So, if you fix breathing or you fix their sleep, people, in theory, should make better choices about the foods that they eat and the amount of food that they eat. I don't know, maybe you might remember this, when we were in residency and we would do a night shift. Like, there's like this urge to have like a big meal coming off of a night shift. And I remember like that was like a thing that we would do as residents, because you finish a night shift, you feel like this sense of like freedom, and you have like a big meal and then you go to sleep. And like that's the worst thing you can do for your metabolism and your health. But it's not us, it's like our hormones are dysregulated and they make us do these things.
Yeah. It's so powerful to even hear you say the term, it's not their fault. I think that's so important to pull out of your words there, because the thought that comes to my mind is kind of the difference between like reasons and excuses. And it's one of those things where this is a reason. Like this isn't a weakness. This isn't something that is just a lack of self-control. This is hormonal. This is the body, in a way, trying to protect itself. It's just being manipulated in an unnatural way through the sleep deprivation, the like you referenced with the night shift examples and such. And I think it's a real strong encouragement that those who don't work night shifts and those who have control over their sleep patterns really take control over their sleep patterns and don't let, scrolling on their phone or working too late at night or having sporadic sleep onset and wake times different between the weekdays and the weekends. Like, don't allow yourself to actually get into that gray zone because of the impacts it's going to have to hormones that then you don't have the some of your behaviors will you won't have the control over. So
Totally.
I think that's a great point to put out there, is to remind people that sleep challenges are deeply the aftermath, a sleep disorder, the complications of it are going to be deeply rooted and trickle into many other areas of health. Very important.
No, 100%, 100%. And we talk about this idea that if your sleep is better, everything that you do will be more effective. If your sleep is worse, everything that you do will be as will be worse. And sleep is the housekeeping process for our body and our physiology. I was talking to someone recently, and I thought like this metaphor was really good. He took out his new iPhone 17, and he was waving it at me, and he said, "Hey, dude, this thing is only useful if it's charged. Like, otherwise, like iPhone 17 versus an iPhone 1, if they're not charged and they don't turn on and their battery sucks, like they're not going to do what they're supposed to do." So, sleep is like the housekeeping process. It's the charging process for us. And if it is broken, then many micro processes are broken as a byproduct of that.
Yeah, I love that analogy, because there's few things in life that can be more frustrating than waking up and realize you forgot to plug in your phone and you start the day at 15% charge and you're like, oh man, it's going to be a long day.
Yeah, totally,
If
totally. Or I need to be
you take
careful.
that.
Or I need to be careful. I need to turn off my location services and run in like low battery power mode for the whole day. And Yeah, no, it's a really spot on metaphor, and it's applicable across our health for sure.
It really is. Well, as we wrap up this conversation, I just want to point back to Empower Sleep. So as I've kind of shared, I'm really passionate about what you're doing. And I think our listeners to these episodes will be too. And if they're interested in connecting with your team, what can they expect? What are the next steps they should take? And what can they expect to come after that?
They can come to our website. We'll share a link in the notes below. And it's, if not, empowersleep.com. And patients have an option to meet with one of our sleep coaches, complimentary, for 30 minutes to share what is going on and to do a discovery call with an official sleep coach to see if like Empower Sleep is a good fit for them and if we can help them or not. Most of the times the answer is yes. And if we feel like we can help them and the patient feels like this is a good fit for them, then they can enroll into our program. And what that entails is they'll receive a home sleep testing ring where they would start off with 7 to 10 nights of baseline home sleep testing. They'll be able to see the results every morning in the app. And once they have established a baseline of sleep health, we'll make sure that they meet with one of our doctors virtually for a whole hour. And this is a deep dive, 1 hour consultation, understanding the overall medical health, sleep health, all the things that they've tried, what has worked, what hasn't worked, go over the results. And then that's when the work starts, both on our end as well as the patient's end. And depending on what's going on, we would continue to meet with the patient every couple of weeks to make tweaks to the care plan while the patient is testing using the ring device and try to get them to better sleep in anywhere between 3 to 6 months, depending on what's going on. If someone has been like a horrible sleeper for, 20 years, that's probably like a 6 month journey. But if someone has just, gained a significant amount of weight in the last 5, 6 years, and now sleep is poor and they have straightforward obstructive sleep apnea, that's a patient journey of about 2 to 3 months. So it really depends on what's going on. But our job is to figure out what's wrong, find a solution, optimize that solution, and graduate you from the program so that you can go back to your primary care physician and check in on an as-needed basis.
That's great. Yeah. And I know I referenced participating in the program. It is so easy through texting, through communication, through the app. It's such an easy process. But to also have such great value following easy processes is so beautiful. Last thing I'll ask, and this is just a general question, because we were talking last episode about how far sleep science has come. What are you looking forward to? What's on the horizon in sleep medicine, not just necessarily at Empower Sleep, but just in sleep medicine that you feel like is on the horizon that could be a real game changer for the future of sleep health?
We're at this really unique intersection where there is like convergence of consumer grade technologies and medical grade diagnostics. And like, I foresee a future where a wearable device will detect and will detect abnormalities and become a diagnostic device that I as a physician can use. And I can then use that to then provide guidance, track progress. And that's something I'm really excited about, because right now we have to mail patients a medical grade device that is separate. They may have to do an in-lab study at, depending on what's going on. And we're using different systems. So I'm really excited that Apple has a sleep apnea detection module, Samsung has a sleep apnea detection module, and over a period of time, these consumer-grade devices are only going to get better, and they're going to give us physicians more information to be able to provide much more personalized care to patients and meet them where they are.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, thanks for sharing that. And Sahil, thanks again for your time. So thankful for what you've shared with us. And I look forward to future conversations with you.
No, thank you, Craig. Thank you so much for all the kind words, the feedback, and thanks for having me today.
Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.